Hello, this is the Abstract Podcast, the podcast that takes the new scientific literature of veterinary neurology to you. No fluff, no stress, just an easy way to catch up with what is new while you drive, exercise, or have breakfast.
We search PubMed every week and select the studies relevant to veterinary neurology that were added this week. You then decide if you prefer to go and read the whole manuscript later. I am Sarah.
And I am Alex. We are AI-generated hosts, but the science discussed is grounded in PubMed. So this is the week from June 7th, 2026 to June 13th, 2026.
This week, we've selected some of the most clinically relevant highlights, with a focus on small animal neurosurgery, medicine, and some fascinating case reports.
Let's kick off with a paper from Veterinary Surgery. This one is really pushing the envelope on surgical planning.
This is a case report from Kaewon and colleagues at Seoul National University in South Korea. They describe a novel dorsal occipito-cervical fixation technique in a small breed dog with complex craniocervical junction anomalies.
And it's a Pomeranian. So we're talking about a tiny patient with a huge problem. It had a fusion of C2 to C-4, hypoplastic condyles, and both atlanto-occipital and atlanto-axial instability. They used a patient-specific 3D-printed implant and drill guide to stabilize it.
Well, let's be clear. It's a case report. N equals 1. We can't draw any broad conclusions about superiority over traditional methods from this.
I hear you. But in the field, this is still a step forward. The outcome was fantastic. Post-op CT showed great alignment. The dog was walking by 2 months. And the fix was stable at a 33-month follow-up. For a case this complex, that's a huge win.
The follow-up is good, I'll grant you that. But the cost and accessibility of this technology, it's a proof of concept, nothing more.
But what a proof of concept. It shows that for these incredibly difficult cases, we have a new, highly precise tool in the arsenal. It could be a game-changer for select patients. Okay, next up, a paper from JAVMA. Looking at the gut-brain axis.
This is a prospective case series by Dewey and colleagues from Elemental Pet Vets in the USA. They investigated the effect of fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT, on dogs with suspected canine cognitive dysfunction.
Right. They gave oral FMT capsules to 11 dogs for 90 days. They were looking for changes in the owner-reported DISHAA scores and in the fecal microbiome.
Preliminary is the operative word here, Alex. The study is tiny. It started with 11 dogs, one dropped out, and then only 6 had complete data for the final analysis. 6!
The high dropout rate is definitely a weakness. But in 4 of those 6 dogs, the DISHAA scores improved, and microbiome diversity increased. That's an interesting signal.
It's an unblinded signal based on subjective owner scores. The placebo effect could be enormous. And what about the 2 dogs that actually got times worse? The paper mentions it, but it certainly undermines the premise. No control group, no blinding. I'm just not buying it yet.
They're very upfront about the limitations and call for a larger, controlled study. But clinically, for CCD, our options are few and far between. FMT is a relatively low-risk intervention. This at least gives us something to discuss with a motivated owner. Let's move to the Journal of Veterinary Medical Science for a couple of really practical papers. First, a case report.
This is from Goda and colleagues at the University of Miyazaki in Japan. It's a case of central nervous system feline infectious peritonitis, or FIP, in an 11-month-old cat.
The cat presented with progressive ataxia, and on MRI, it had a well-defined, solitary mass on the left side of the fourth ventricle. It really looked like a primary brain tumor.
But histopathology of the excised tissue confirmed it was FIP. It's a very useful reminder that FIP can present as a discrete, neoplastic-like mass, not just as the more common diffuse ependymitis or hydrocephalus.
Exactly. The report underscores that FIP has to be on the differential list for any intracranial mass in a young cat, even if it looks well circumscribed on imaging. This is a great one for the residents to read.
Indeed. It serves its purpose as a clinical reminder, confirming a known, if uncommon, presentation of a common disease.
Staying with the same journal, a study on radiation therapy.
This is from Nomoto and colleagues at Yamaguchi University in Japan. They used Monte Carlo simulations to compare three different orthovoltage beam directions for treating feline nasal lymphoma.
This is super relevant for practices that don't have a linear accelerator. They modeled the radiation dose on CT images from five clinical cases.
So to be clear, this is a computer simulation, not a treatment study on live animals. They looked at directing the beam perpendicular to the hard palate, perpendicular to the nasal bridge, or from inside the oral cavity.
And the results are quite practical. The beam direction made a significant difference to the dose delivered to the organs at risk. For instance, the plan coming from the oral cavity delivered a significantly lower dose to the ipsilateral eye.
The sample size is small, but for a modeling study, it's probably sufficient to demonstrate the principle. It really just highlights the critical importance of meticulous treatment planning to spare sensitive structures like the eyes and brain.
Right. It's a solid, practical paper that gives clinicians using orthovoltage a clear message. Think very carefully about your angles. It can make a huge difference to your patient's outcome. All right, let's look at a fascinating case of envenomation from the journal Toxicon.
This is a case report by Heffer and colleagues in Israel. It's the first documented case of a dog envenomated by the black fat-tailed scorpion, Timeskymes androctonus bicolor.
The clinical signs were dramatic and had a clear neurologic basis. The dog initially presented with collapse, hypersalivation, and trouble breathing. This quickly progressed to nystagmus, severe muscle spasms, tachycardia, and hypertension, a classic autonomic storm.
But what I found most clinically relevant was the second phase of the illness. The dog was discharged, but returned 5 days later with tremors, hematochezia, and lab work consistent with pancreatitis.
Yes. The authors flag this as a newly recognized potential sequela. It suggests the venom induces a massive systemic inflammatory response that can lead to delayed complications. It's a critical point for emergency clinicians.
It is a single data point, of course, being a case report. But the association is biologically plausible. It's a good heads up to monitor for pancreatitis in these patients, even after the initial neurotoxic crisis has passed.
For our final paper, we're taking a look at a One Health topic from Scientific Reports.
This is a study from Crispo and colleagues in France, providing pathological evidence of neurotropism and oculotropism in wild black-headed gulls naturally infected with H5N1 high pathogenicity avian influenza.
This was a really thorough investigation of field cases from a major outbreak. They performed full workups on 13 affected gulls.
The key finding was the marked neurotropism. The birds showed clear central neurological signs, and immunohistochemistry confirmed viral antigen throughout the neuronal tissue. But even more striking was the eye involvement.
Exactly. They consistently found anterior uveitis and retinal degeneration, with viral antigen in intraocular structures. The authors make a strong case that the eye is a primary target organ for this virus.
This has significant implications. It could influence viral shedding, persistence, and transmission routes. They also noted a lack of endotheliotropism, which helps define the pathogenic profile of this specific H5N1 clade.
It's a crucial paper for any veterinarian involved in wildlife health or disease surveillance. It establishes that severe neurologic and ocular signs are hallmarks of this HPAI strain in gulls.
That wraps up this week's literature. Please remember that an abstract-only appraisal cannot evaluate full methodology. The scope of this podcast is to provide a taster, to stimulate your appetite to read the actual manuscripts of those papers that capture your interest.
Also, please note that we are AI-generated hosts and may occasionally get details wrong. It is ultimately your responsibility to double-check the veracity of the information, particularly if this is going to affect your clinical practice. Thanks for listening.